gentlemen, thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now, I would like to turn the meeting over to Lynn Parker.
I'm actually not Lynn Parker, but I will be turning it over to her shortly. My name is Lita Benenson. I'm a AAAS fellow serving in the SIES Directorate, and I am also a co-organizer for the Data Science Seminar Series here at the National Science Foundation, and I want to thank you all for making it here. I know it's been a very crazy week, and I know a lot of meetings got moved to this day as well, but I do think this will be a very engaging conversation. The format of this seminar is Dr. Jordan has offered to do about a 15-minute presentation with some slides, and then following that, you will be in a moderated discussion with Dr. Lynn Parker as well. And with that, I would like to introduce you to the Division Director of Information and Intelligence Systems here in SIES, Lynn Parker, to introduce Michael Jordan to our series. Thank you.
Thank you, Lita, and I also appreciate all of you coming on such a snowy week, and Dr. Jordan as well for coming so early on Berkeley time. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Michael Jordan, although those of us that are in the field know that he really needs no introduction. He is the Pi-Hung Chin Distinguished Professor in Electrical Engineering and Computer Science, as well as in Statistics at the University of California at Berkeley. And previous to that, he spent 10 years as a faculty member at MIT in brain and cognitive science. And I think it's that multidisciplinary perspective that we can really appreciate from Dr. Jordan's work, because he brings not only the AI and machine learning side, the computational statistical side, but also the cognitive and brain and biological sciences perspectives to his work. And so because of those perspectives, he's made tremendous advances in a lot of different areas. The areas that he's worked in are areas such as Bayesian nonparametric analysis, probabilistic graphical models, spectral methods, kernel methods, and applications of all of these to problems in distributed computing, natural language processing, signal processing, and statistical genetics. His work is really seminal and is well recognized by many awards and lots of best paper awards and in many different areas. For instance, recently one of his papers with some of his co-authors was recognized as the 10-year best paper for the International Conference on Machine Learning. He's received ACM AAAI Alan Newell Award, and recently he chaired a National Academy study on frontiers in massive data analysis. Obviously, we at NSF also care about education, and it seems that all of the seminal leaders in the field of machine learning make their way through Dr. Jordan's lab, either as postdocs or as students. And so many of his former students and postdocs are at places like Baidu, Columbia University, University of Cambridge, and RIA, and so forth. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences as well as the National Academy of Engineering, and he's a fellow of I think, every major organization, professional society in machine learning, statistics, engineering, computing, mathematics. So it's with great pleasure that we welcome Dr. Michael Jordan.
Thank you, Lynn. My pleasure to be here. I come from a place where it's about 60 degrees right now. It snowed since 1972. I don't know if that makes you feel worse or better. I thought I'd mention it. So I have a few slides to present, and I really look forward to a give and take. The word computational thinking I associate with NSF from Jeanette Wing's time. I know Facebook is the word, and I think it was a useful attempt to broaden the scope of computer science, talk about everybody's in it together, it's a broad area. It's not just classical computer science, but it reaches all the sciences and technology. I think that there's room for another word, which is another phrase, which is what I'm going to call inferential thinking. And what I really hope to do in the first 15 minutes is convince you about that it's useful to delimit what computational thinking is and place right aside it on the same pedestal of inferential thinking, and in some sense think of data science as the cooperation of the two. That's going to be the goal of the talk. Let's see if I remember which button it is. Let's just point a briefly review kind of semi-historically the big data phenomenon.
There have been so many talks about this that there are countless, but what I want to do on this slide is remind you of where data is coming from, but actually also what's the inferential issue? What questions are being asked of the data that go behind the data? Try to think about what was the phenomenon and trying to think about predictions for the future. That's the inferential side of data analysis. Let's always keep size and the scope and velocity of data in mind, but let's also keep what the questions being asked and what the uncertainty about them. So at least in my limited view of the world, it was the large-scale science projects that started to originally talk about lots and lots of data and what can we do with it, what are the problems, and so on. So, you know, going back to the 90s, particle physicists were gathering huge amounts of data, obviously. Now, why were they gathering it? Well, some of the questions that were raised were classical hypothesis testing questions. Is there a Higgs boson or not? Okay, so statistically or inferentially, in some sense, a simple classical problem. But if there was no Higgs boson, there was a certain model, and it was very, very complicated, and there were certain density curves, had a lot of wiggles to them, if there was a Higgs boson, you have essentially the same curve with a little tiny extra blip. And to say whether that blip is real or not required huge amounts of data. You had to be in energy regimes which were unusual, and you had to get, so the noise was being amplified, you had to gather huge amounts of data. So huge amounts of data being gathered, but just ask a 0-1 question, right? So it's safe, but it's not the most common mode. The more common mode is exploratory mode. So soon thereafter, or around the same times, astronomy started to do sky atlas and gather everything you could about the sky. Genomics obviously arose, gather everything you can gather about human genomes and animal genomes. And here the inferential issue is completely different. It's not testing a classical hypothesis. It's gather new phenomena that could be interesting that future generations of scientists can study. So statistically, the condition is completely different. It's more like a control of error rates. I'm going to return maybe 1,000 hypotheses and see where it's following up. Let's make sure that at least like 990 of them are actually reasonably likely to be true. Okay? Now, classical statistics took one hypothesis and said 95% of the time, you know, it's going to be a true hypothesis in some sense. Here it's completely different. It's huge, vast numbers of hypotheses. Let's find a fraction of those which are likely to be what's following up. So that's been studying statistics, but not at the scale that the astronomers and genomicists were trying to look at. So that's an ongoing issue in data science. Think about that. All right, so that was the science side, and then, you know, it's around the same time, but probably a little bit after it became more technology-oriented. All the companies now in Silicon Valley are doing data, big data, some kind of. Now, to me, what was interesting about it wasn't just, again, the scale and size of the data. That's kind of, almost called boring, but it's not as interesting as what's the inferential problems. And what it really, I think, comes down to me was that it was about personalization. It was that, well, we suddenly have enough data about not just global behavior of human beings, but about every single human. And we can make predictions for each human being. Right? There's a granularity of the data. And the inferentially, the question is, how can we actually do that? Because we have huge amounts of data about some people, a little bit about other people, and very little about some, you know, a long tail. And how can we make sure that we make good decisions across that gamut? Right? So we have to somehow link the individuals. We have to think really in a sophisticated way about personalization. Of course, it's not just humans. You know, when you gather the whole sky, you're saying, I have now information on every part of the sky, not just about astronomical phenomena in general, or the genome. I have information now literally about every single gene, every regulatory region. I've got a lot of data about each one of them. How can I do good inferences across the entire set of them? So to me, it's about personalization. In fact, that's most of the companies when I consult. It's all about, let's take a classical service and make it personal. So the inferential issues now become really quite interesting. It's heterogeneity when you start gathering data, thinking about vast numbers of individuals. Unknown sampling, how did I collect a large number of those individuals or a few of these? How did that work out? And I'll think about compound loss on the next slide. All right, so that's kind of data source meets inferential issue. And, of course, there's how do you do this computationally? Now, I think these are really challenging intellectual issues for the next, you know, 100 years. I don't think these are sort of, we know how to do them, let's just build the systems. So here's a little slide that tries to get into some somewhat picaresque way, perhaps. So I imagine one of my students, maybe an undergrad student, finishing up at Berkeley, going down to Silicon Valley, or nowadays across the Bay in San Francisco, and having this conversation with his or her boss. So boss says, I need a big data system, whatever that means, that will replace our classic service with a personalized service. So a classic service might be e-commerce or search, Google search or something. I want to now make it different for each individual who arrives at my website. Okay, well, I might be able to do that. You know, the classical service was based on some kind of a model built from data, including the Google search function, a model built from data, across all individuals. Let's just now do it for subsets of individuals. Maybe I'll do one model for every individual. All right, you know, I can start to think about how to do that. You have to give me a lot more computers, but, you know, we could probably do this. Now it gets worse. It gets harder because your boss says, it should work reasonably well for anyone and everyone. I can tolerate a few errors, but not too many dumb ones that will embarrass us. All right, so we're still kind of on the statistical side here, and the challenge has to be really, really hard. You can't tolerate 5% errors or even 0.001 errors. If you're serving a billion people, hundreds of millions, and 5% or 1% of them are getting really bad service, they're going to complain right to the newspapers. Your business is going to tank. You have no hope. You've got to serve everybody well, essentially everybody, except for the rare case. Okay? So it's kind of the L infinity norm. It's not the L2 norm or the L1 norm anymore. It's the L infinity norm is what we have to focus on. It's evaluatory statisticians. So that puts us in a new class of problems. All right, now it gets even worse. Now the computer science comes in, which is that this new service you're providing has got maybe hundreds of millions of models, and I've got to put them on various servers and all that, and I've got to find enough data to feed them, and I've got to bring them up at the right time and all that. So that's going to be a lot of challenges. And the service should not have slowed down from the point of view of the user. So with Google search, I hit a button within tens of milliseconds, I expect an answer. Otherwise, I'll go to some other website. Suddenly, I provide this new service, which is going to be personalized, it's going to be better. But if I hit a button and I wait hundreds of milliseconds, it's not better. All right, so now it really is hard because how do I do a statistical inference problem in the L infinity norm well and do it computationally with guarantees it will finish in tens of milliseconds? So I'd say we don't know how to do that at all. We don't have a science of that. We don't have a science of control loss function or risk functions. That's what we're trying to control here. That's what an error rate is. It's a risk function. Control risk as a function of computational resources. Right? So I don't think we know how to do it. So you build systems and hope they work, and you have one knob which always helps you, which is the degree of parallelism. You can turn up the number of computers and hope that you put the service on the platform, it'll run fast and try it out. But it's maybe really expensive, right? And now things only get worse. Because your boss says, well, it shouldn't slow down as we collect more data. We're going to collect, so today we have, you know, hundreds of gigabytes of data, but, you know, in 10 years we'll have huge amounts more. Surely the service will only get better. We have more of our resource. We have more of what we, you know, making the service work, lots of data. Surely we should only get better. Right? But classical computer science, in some sense, says, no, you'll get worse. You'll slow down. You need more resources. N log n, n squared, n cubed, whatever. It'll only get slower. Right? So you say, well, okay, maybe I can put more computers, throw more computers at it. And right now you need equations from computer science saying how many computers is a function of the risk and a function of the inferential problem and as a function of the amount of data. It's also, we don't have such equations. We don't have anything like such equations. We just have an empirical practice. Let's try it out, see if it works. All right, so as a kind of a scientific engineering kind of person, I just think this is completely unacceptable. I don't think we have a field yet. An engineering version of statistics needs computation. I think that we don't have that. All right, of course, it only gets worse. If you're working in the real world. So in particular, lots of, let's call them externalities. There's privacy concerns. This is data, you know, who knows what kind of data it is, and people might care about how you use their data. So you don't want to just say, well, you can't use it or you can use it. That's kind of where we are nowadays. That's just wrong. Society is being hurt by that. So you have to have knobs, things like differential privacy. We can turn the knob a little bit. But again, it's not just a computing issue. You turn it as a function of the computational resources. No, it's about individual loss functions and individual preferences. Like at every individual a knob, they turn the knob and then you collect the data and you see what your inferential result is. And you want to control the inferential result, which needs to be good. The error rate needs to be low as a function of all the knobs that people are turning. Okay, so now the person just quits the job because it's over. All right. So I think that's where we are. That's the kind of class of problems that are we're trying to face. So I think of this as requiring a blend of, let's call it, computational thinking. How do I put data on servers? How do I move them around? How do I distribute it? How do I serve it? How do I do all the things that distributed systems and databases will do? But I do that in the context of inferential questions. How do I control error rates across different kinds of sources of data for different types of questions? So computational thinking, again, that's kind of the word that's been around for a long time. Computer science is not just a scripting language or a computer language, it's abstraction, modularity, capability. Inferential thinking. Consider the real-world phenomena behind the data, not just look at the data. Consider the sampling pattern that gave rise to it. Develop procedures that go backward from the data to the underlying phenomena.
So it's not just that you run statistics or machine learning algorithms on some kind of a database. That's not inferential thinking. That's maybe descriptive statistics, but it's not inference. So we got to think about error bars or confidence intervals on all of our outputs. So if I have a database, my belief is what we need to have is every database ever built takes in a query, gives it an answer with a confidence interval. You can't make decisions without confidence intervals, so we should start to provide it. And currently, sort of no databases provide confidence intervals. So conceptually, the challenges are really daunting. So the core theories in computer science and statistics developed separately over the last 100 years. And there's oil and water problems. So in core statistical theory, statistical decision theory, you have loss functions, you have probabilities, you have risks, and you control risk as a function of things like amount of data, N, the dimension of the space, P, complexity of the hypothesis space, you know, script H, whatever, and you have a bunch of equations that relate all those things. But in those equations, you never have runtime. There is not a symbol for runtime, and it doesn't appear in those equations. So there's very surrogates for like amount of data, but you know, if n is the amount of data, runtime could be n cubed or n squared or n squared p or whatever. It's just we need equations like that. We don't have them. They're missing. Similarly, in computer science, core computational theory is, you know, computational complexity theory or communication complexity or various sorts of that. You'll never find the word risk. Okay, you'll find optimization principles. You'll find maybe loss. You'll never find expectation of a loss, a risk function. So you don't control risk. You control geometric errors or worst case, mismatch, you know, sort of somewhat arbitrary ones. You won't find things that a human would care about, which is here's my loss function, and I want you to control the error rate to start that loss function. Okay, so, and it's hard to put these together. If it had been easy, it would have happened already. It's really, really quite challenging. So in a longer talk, here's what I have, this is kind of the first few slides from a longer talk, where I'm trying to try to dig into several of the ways to bring all these constraints together and actually get equations. I'm just going to turn it. I have some slides here. There we go. That kind of bring home this computational thinking, inferential thinking in the domain of privacy. So I skipped over a slide there that sort of said what I said in English. We want to build systems where everybody can say, here's how much privacy I need or want for that problem, that loss function, and that class of data. So it's my genomic data, for example, I want sort of have a knob that says, I'll ask you, what are you using my genomic data for? Are you studying a disease that runs in my family? Then sure, I'll turn the knob all the way up. You're going to have my data. Are you trying to set insurance rates? I'll turn the knob down. If you're trying to set, you know, just sell me stuff on the web, I'll turn the knob up. But I want to have that knob as a function of the problem. So let's look at this in kind of a little cartoon. So there has been a lot of work at privacy, you know, different sorts and many other forms of it, mostly in the database and crypto communities. And you might think they're also kind of doing some statistics there, is a little bit, because you see things like medians and means. And I'm going to argue that's not the case, so this slide makes sense too. So a classical database person, you build a database, a query comes in, and you give it an answer, and I'm going to use the Greek symbol for the answer. I'm going to call it theta with a little twiddle over it. So it looks kind of silly right now, but you'll see why I'm doing it. So some query comes in, some answer comes out, it might be numerical, it might be qualitative. We'll call it theta twiddle. And the privacy problem is to design an operator, usually randomized, called Q, which takes the original data and in some sense smushes it up, creates a privatized database that you're free to query, at least in some limited way. You put the same query into it and you get out an answer, theta hat. And the theory of differential privacy and other such theories prove that the difference between theta twiddle and theta hat is small, okay, over all queries in some family, okay, with high probability. That's the kind of you do. Right? So you design Q to achieve that, and there are ways to design it. Add Laplace noise, do randomized response, and so on and so forth. All right, so that's pretty, you know, you compute a kind of satisfying state of affairs, that can be done. And if the query is something like compute the mean or the median, or do a linear regression, it looks like you can even do statistics with this. All right, so I'm going to argue that's not the way to think. And here's kind of what I hope will help convince you that. So let's suppose the database is the bank, and there's accounts in the bank. So it's the address and height and weight and amount, you know, in the account for a bunch of individuals, right? So I really care about the amounts, you know, so I'm going to do things like the maximal amount might be a query or the median might be a query and so on and so forth. So I'm going to do descriptive statistics on my database, and I care about that. Now, let's compare that to a different problem, which is I've collected medical data. So it's people's age, height, weight, and so on, maybe blood pressure, and then it's how long they live if I give them some treatment. Okay? Something like that. All right. Now, again, I care about maybe means and medians over this, but
And in both cases, I care about the privacy of the individuals in the database. Certainly the banking situation, I want to be like Switzerland, like privacy, but also in the medical situation. I want to protect everybody's privacy, right? But now, what kind of questions do I want to ask of this data? Well, in the medical case, I'm also going to be interested in how well does this treatment work for people who aren't in my database? Right? In fact, let's just imagine that the people in the database are all dead and gone. Does that mean my database is useless? You know? No, it's totally useful data, because I'm going to use it probably as a doctor to predict how well a treatment will work for people in the future. Right? People like the people in the database, but not those people. I don't really care about them. I just sampled them. They're just samples. Right? Whereas in the banking case, you know, I'm probably not going to ask what would be the typical account for somebody who's not in my bank. Maybe I might. That's kind of modern data science, but that's maybe not the classical database then. So the statistician says, a query comes into a database. I want to gather answer theta twiddle. Behind the database, there was a population of other people who could have been in the database. I'm actually interested in those people. Okay? I'm not just interested in the data itself. I'm interested in other people who could have been in the database. That's the statistician's perspective. And there's a sampling operator, and I have to think about the sampling operator because that'll be part of my inference. All right? So I can put the same query to the population. I can ask questions about people who are in the database. I can get an answer. Let's not call that theta. And statistical theory of the last 100 years is I can prove that theta is close to theta twiddle with high probability over all sampling operators, over all queries, and over all P in various samples. That's what statistics does. And again, very satisfying theory. But now you can see where I'm going. I consider that inferential. You're saying, what's behind the data? Can I say things about new things that could happen or counterfactuals? That's inference. And a computational person in a database of a database field typically does not think that way. Not think about those kind of questions. Right? What if the data has been sampled differently? What about new people? Okay? And now I hope you know where I'm going. We want to put them together. Okay? If we put them together, now we're blending inferential thinking and computational thinking. We can solve the problem we want to say. We now have a database of people who are dead and gone, but it's good medical data. Right? And I want to take down new people out of the population. I want good predictions for them. So I want to prove that theta is close to theta hat. Overall samplings, S, and overall Qs, and overall queries, and overall Ps. All right. There's the kind of challenge that I think that we should be facing. As a unified community, I would call this core data science. I mean, data science is everywhere. Everywhere has data is doing something like data science, but this is the core. If you can solve problems like this, they'll have repercussions through lots and lots of fields. All right. And also now think about replace privacy with communication. You know, strained communication. And do good inference under constrained communication. Or replace privacy with computation. I'm going to only let you have a certain number of cycles on the computer or a certain memory resource. Make sure that you achieve that. And under the constraint you do that, give me good inference. Make theta be close to theta hat under constraints on something else, privacy or anything else. Right? And again, I don't think we have those theories. So I think I'm going to finish there. The rest of my talk with are my attempts at my research group at Berkeley to actually solve some of those problems. And I think in the case of privacy, I think we actually have a solution. We have a not a very nice one. There's papers now we have on this. And so in the case of computation, we don't have a solution, nor does anyone else have it. So Turing's theory of complexity is just too worst case. It's just not the right theory to go together with statistical risk. And some of the theories come out of optimization. Oracles from optimization are a little more helpful. They start to get a little more handle on it. But I think the hard problems are still open and challenging and interesting. Okay, so I hope that's provocative enough to get the conversation started.
Great. So at this time, we'll transition to a conversation. Thank you. Yeah, we'll transition to a conversation. You want to have a seat? Yep. Or do you
I actually stand to be able to see everybody?
Okay.
Come to the table. I'm realizing reading isn't optimal, and I think this would be a little bit better.
So I'm happy to moderate the discussion. Just to kick this off, Michael, what do you think NSF's role is in helping to facilitate this new way of thinking about the problem? Is it an education challenge? Is it an infrastructure challenge? Is it a resource challenge?
Well, so top to bottom, I mean, I hope I'm giving the picture. I think this is transformational for academia, certainly. How we educate students has got to change at the undergrad level, certainly at the grad level, you know, and how we work within academia. But it's much broader than that, right? It's every company in the world is trying to hire people who think this way because their problems cross all these boundaries. So when you start to try to do it, you run into a media, I don't know how to do it. So there are just immense research challenges. So I think NSF has been pretty good about interdisciplinary over the years that I've been an academic.
you know, but this is a particular comment that I just hope is being, it's unfortunate you're thinking that I know there are some statisticians in the audience and there's some computer scientists and you probably know each other, but at least in academics, the distance is still quite large. They have some appreciation over there, but they often reinvent the wheel. They often aren't appreciative of what the other field can contribute, and they aren't appreciative also what the things that aren't easy to do. You can't just kind of blend things together. So I'll leave that for you to kind of speculate about what you might best do, but I think the challenges are, you know, and I didn't even get into this, just like how does this turn into public policy decisions? How do you kind of worry about, how do you control errors when you, do things in public policy setting? How does this influence the social sciences and so on? So I think it's best to kind of think very, very broadly about it, maybe going top down. Just think, you know, tell everybody what in your area are the data issues? Like a graphics person, you know, if I have data, how does that change graphics? I think you'll find that amazing numbers of new questions come to the fore.
Great. We'd like to open up to the audience. Do you all have questions? Well, on this, there's this new high-performance computing strategic computing initiative that's coming out, and some of the new thinking about the computational side of the house is maybe there needs to be completely new models of computation that can facilitate the big data computation. Have you had any thoughts on whether the computational infrastructure is well-suited for big data research and in what ways it might be changed to help facilitate that area of research?
It's been about 10 years now ago in working with systems colleagues at Berkeley. We had a lab called the Rad Lab, which was sort of statisticians, mainly me, helping out in the design of data centers kind of internally. How do you make a data center better by internally collecting data and then changing policies about how you run the data center? And that was the Rad Lab, and then it transitioned to sort of the computer science systems people helping me and machine learning people to design data analysis stacks. I think that we're still not to the end of just exploring how do you take commodity hardware and networks and parallel distributed systems and try to map that on inferential problems. So I think we've made huge progress in the AMP lab. It's only been 3 years, but in building a really serious data analysis stack that people are using in the real world. But I can tell you there's a whole list of problems we haven't solved there that we're kind of working on that I think if we can solve, that'll really be transformational. If I go to most of the companies in the Bay Area who are doing what I think are leading, cutting edge data science, Amazon certainly on the top of my list, but, the usual suspects, Google, Uber, so on, they don't need new big shiny computers. They don't need new paradigms. They don't need quantum computing. They need, how do I actually put data on computers and make it move around such that I make good inferences fast? Right, and they have enough. I think there's enough electrons moving fast enough on these systems. It's really how do I organize them. That's my personal perspective, but I'm not as enamored with the neural or the quantum or whatever. I think that we should in parallel perceive that. But I think there's so many hard, challenging problems that are really about the information and inferential side.
I think we have a microphone. This one. We're going to use this one.
Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. Yeah.
So we noticed recently a massive increase in centers, or not quite departments yet, in data science. So in this area, we've got two or three universities have already started centers in data science.
Right.
We've also noticed that there does seem, particularly in the database and the information retrieval areas, a confluence of research by computer scientists and by strong statisticians to basically take data mining and make it a science. That is, the multivariate statistics have gotten stronger so that they can support some of the data mining variables. Do you see a kind of confluence of statistics departments and computer science departments coming together into a new field, basically what you described?
Yes, great question. So at Berkeley, I can tell you we're trying to do exactly that. There's talk of a new school that would house statistics and computer science so they can interact better, and then some version of social science, because somehow that's the new area where the application are the strongest and we can make most impact. So that triad, I think, is also being looked at other universities. Okay, that triad is being looked at other universities as well.
And I think new organizational paradigms to support that are really important. The first thing we've done is to develop a new freshman course. If you look at databears.berkeley.edu, you'll see a new syllabus that we've taught last semester that is a blend of inferential and computational thinking. So I led this team that did this, and the goal, the way of thinking about it was that every idea should have an inferential side to it. So how do I do A-B testing? That's kind of an inferential question. How do I solve it? Well, maybe permutation test. How do I put permutations on a computer? How do I random permutations? That's a programming exercise. So we teach them Python along with inferential principles with working with real data off and social data. At the freshman level, it's been a huge success. There's no math in it, but that doesn't mean it's not rigorous. It's totally rigorous. It's permutation tests and bootstrap and so on, and it's Python. And we're doing it for a wide swath of students at Berkeley. It was 100 in the first round of fall, and now we had 500 sign up for it. This spring, it's running right now, and the students are loving it, raving about it. So I think that new organizational paradigms to support that kind of class is really critical. Otherwise, you don't, you kind of get half of the paradigm. You don't get the whole one.
I think we have a question.
Okay. Mike answered it with that.
Oh, okay. Great. Are these okay?
I'll just hold this one closer to me.
Okay.
Operator, are there any questions on the phone?
This is the operator. If you do have a question, please press star 1. To withdraw your request, press star 2. One moment. We'll wait to see if there's any questions. And Simon Garfinkel, you may go ahead with your question.
Thank you. I'd like the speaker to address the question of inferential privacy. So how do I protect my privacy if people who are like me are giving up information that I think should be kept private, like family members giving out genomic information, neighbors answering surveys that neighborhood that I don't want surveyed?
So, yeah, good technical question about differential privacy. How do I protect when people like me are giving data? There is a differential privacy is a likelihood ratio criterion. Inferential privacy. You know, I'm trying to, so I'm just, differential privacy itself can protect privacy under various of the kind of models you were talking about. It's a likelihood ratio criterion. I look at the output of a channel with me in the database and the output of a channel with me not in the database. And I take the ratio of those probabilities over all the events I could look at. And I keep that ratio within a band around 1. All right? So if I have a likelihood, which includes the fact that there are lots of similar people to me, all right, then I'm going to be, I'll have to have a more stringent control to assure that I don't leak privacy when I get information about you. Okay? But also remember that these models include the randomization. So if I give the treatment to you and I give the control to your wife, then the randomization will help me with keeping that likelihood ratio close, even though you are similar. You live in the same address and so on and so forth. Right? But the math is just literally a probability ratio being controlled, and that probability ratio includes all the assumptions you're making about how the individuals are related, and you have to do that. You're absolutely right. Your intuition is correct that if you don't protect privacy when there's lots of related individuals, things could leak, so you have to control that. So just to say kind of where our research goes on inferential privacy, we're able to give you an equation which says that the minimax risk, which classically goes as 1 over the number of data points or 1 over the square of the number of data points, goes as 1 over number of data points times alpha squared, where alpha is the differential privacy parameter. So if I set that parameter as an individual to 1/2, I kind of have a modest desire to protect my privacy. 1/2 squared is 1/4. I may take 1/4 times n as the effective sample size I have under privacy control. So if you want to get the same risk, you've got to collect 4 times as much data. And you'll know that before you see any data. And if someone says, no, I want my privacy parameter to be more stringent, then alpha squared gets smaller. I got to collect more data to get the same level of risk. There's no magic. You just, you know, but the equations will tell you that to achieve a certain error rate, here's how much data you need as a function of dimension, as a function of the problem size, and as a function of the probability distribution, which includes the relatedness of the individuals.
I have a question, really, basically, just to ask you to comment on a little piece that was on the NewsHour last night where Miles O'Brien was discussing the game Go, and was asserting and saying that computers are now able to beat some of the best players at that game, and yet the game requires a lot of inferential thinking and intuition and intuitive thinking. And so I was just, you know, sort of trying to figure out, well, what does that mean in terms of progress that has been made in computer science? And I thought maybe I'd just ask you to comment on that. I don't know much about the game. I don't know if others may do, but I hear it's pretty complex.
Right. So, that's real. That work is done. It's a blend of neural nets. Let's call it sort of statistical regression, non-parametric regression, with something called reinforcement learning, which is kind of the modern AI version of search. So a classical AI thing was you'd search a big old tree and you do, backtracking and on. And reinforcement learning is something like doing stochastic rollouts. So I kind of try various paths randomly, and I get information propagating back up the tree by doing that. So in the case of Go, they got some training data from actual human beings. Here's the pattern on the board. Here's what you would do if you're a master. That was used as labeled data to train a first neural net. They used that then inside of a tree to do reinforcement learning. Got information, started backing up, and started to develop a better policy based on that. And then they let the algorithm play itself a lot of times and slowly improve. So these are all ideas that date back to the 80s. It's neural nets and reinforcement learning. It's part of the field of statistical machine learning and broadly speaking. And it's being done in a large-scale way, to solve, not every problem in the world. Some of the hype is a little too extreme for me. Vision problems are, there's enough data now that you have enough labels of labeled parts of images that you can start to solve those vision problems and speech problems. I still think natural language is sort of beyond, where we are currently. I think that there's still some very, very hard problems there that don't just fall if you have lots and lots of data. You need intuition. If the subjective experience of a human is lots of intuition. All right, but just like in the image labeling place, my subjective experience in the room is that it's very complicated, but I can piece out little parts of it. But the computer doesn't need to know all that. It just finds representations of edges and shapes and pieces, and it puts them together. And similarly in the Go case, there's just a pattern, and there are certain parts of the pattern which are correlated to, move choices. If you kind of look at the long line of how good a move choice is, you'll start to eventually find a representation that includes that. So I think it's great that there's these kind of successes, but we shouldn't get our heads too high in the clouds. You often don't have that kind of labeled data. Lots of problems aren't like Go. At the end of the day, Go is a deterministic problem. It's a search. Lots of human problems aren't that.
And we do have another question. Donald Costello, you may go ahead with your question.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The problem you discuss are filled with a number of sub-problem challenges. And my background is in math, stat, and computer science. And I work with a number of computational scientists, and I'm still working fairly hard with them who have limited background in computer science and math and stat. And I'm still trying to get them to just work with multivariate analysis alone, not with any of the problems you mentioned. Maybe I'm overstating the number or understating or whatever the number of computational scientists in universities that are able to handle this problem, but I think it's an enormous issue. It's not something you just think that there's people out there that can attack this problem in general. There's very few that have the energy, that have the willingness that it takes to go at all these levels of problems you described. So my question is, how do you go about making this more general approach real? I just think it's blue sky to think that there's going to be that many people who can do this. And the last comment, could you tell me that Berkeley site you mentioned with the introductory course?
The last question I can first answer. It's called Data Bears, all one word, Data Bears, BEARS, .berkeley.edu. So I resonated to everything you said about how big a challenge it is or anything until you got to the blue sky comment. I don't agree. I mean, I think it's just like maybe in the 50s, we have to reorient ourselves as a society, all from top to bottom. We have to be better at quantitative about computer science and statistics, and we have to do it because there's new business models, new health models, new public policy models that are demanded. If we don't do it, we're missing the boat, and we have to. And just to say why it's not blue sky. So in this freshman course, one of the things we taught was bootstrap errors on regression for prediction. Okay, so now if you're a statistician, you may know what this is. Let me just sort of say what this means. You know, what's regression? I have a cloud, I have a little scatter plot, you know, of points, all right? And regression, of course, I think you all know, you put a line through the scatter plot, all right? That's already kind of interesting. It's a way to visualize data and think about whether one variable is related to the other. Right now, typically in a stat curriculum, it gets really complicated. You introduce all the linear algebra that's needed to do this, to invert the matrix and all that. You introduce the F distribution to do something, you know, and it gets hopeless. And indeed, there it's very few people who fall that path all the way to the end where they can do something complicated. Moreover, it's typically all that math is actually asymptotic. It's not true. Moreover, it's probably all not what you really need. So here's an example of what you might really need. I have a scatter plot of data. Here's a brand new X query point I never saw in the data. I want to make a prediction for that X point. All right, you know, so like here's location and temperature. Here's a new location. What's the temperature going to be? Okay? All right, so moreover, so you might think, well, I could fit a regression line and whatever that means and find and look up a point on that regression line and return an answer. But now I say to you, well, what's the error bar around that? Well, how uncertain are you of that? All right, so in this freshman course, I taught the lecture in which we arrived at this sort of in the third month. We arrived at this point, and about 10 room hands shot up through the room. They'd never learned any math. There'd been no matrices, no linear algebra, no probability, no calculus. They said, well, it's really obvious what you do. What you do is you take your original scatter plot. There's endpoints there. You resample them with replacement. You know, now you get a new data set. You put one of those lines, like, oh, that's called a regression line. You put a line through that. And you look up the Y point, and you do that again. You get a new data set with replacement, and you put another line. And now you get a whole bunch of little Y points. You make a histogram out of those. And now you have you have a prediction on the uncertainty. They reinvented on the spot the bootstrap for regression and prediction. Okay? So that's not blue sky. That's like a whole bunch of Berkeley undergrads who had no previous exposure to statistics and to computing, and they didn't do any math, who were able to do something which is very sophisticated and what you really would want to do in industrial practice. So I just think we got to take good ideas like Bootstrap. Bootstrap is a. So I often give talks at places like MIT or CMU, and I ask people, how many of you know what the fast Fourier transform is? And everybody raises their hand. They all know what that is. I say, how many of you know what the Bootstrap is? And maybe a third at best raise their hand. You know, and that's shocking to me. One of the good ideas out of signal processing in the last century is known by everybody. One of the good ideas for statistics from the last century is known by almost nobody. And it's really, so it's just, so that's not blue sky. The first thing I want to do is everybody should know what the bootstrap is. And you can do that in a freshman class.
Would you repeat what it is?
Bootstrap is that, so suppose I give you a list of 100 numbers and I say, what's the median? All right, you may do 100 measurements on me to decide whether you're going to give me an operation or not, like doing a heart operation. And if that median comes out to be bigger than 5, you're going to do the operation. So you do collect the 100 numbers, and the number comes out to be 5.01. And you say, well, I'm going to do you're my doctor. You say, you do the operation. I say, wait a minute. What's the error bar on that? Are you sure it's really over 5? Did you collect enough data? And so on and so forth. And you say, well, I don't know how to get an error bar around the median. Right? If it had been the mean, I would have known. There's something called the standard error of the mean. There's a formula for it. There's not a formula for the median. So now the computer science comes to play. Here's how you can get an error bar on the median or anything else. You take those 100 numbers. How do you get a median? You take the 100 numbers, you sort them. You run a sorting algorithm, and you find the one in the middle. That's the algorithm, okay? Now, to get an error bar, that number came out to be 5.01. What I do is I take that original set of 100 numbers. I resample them with replacement, okay? So the first number might have occurred, and then the fourth number, and then the seventh number, and then the first number occurs again, and so on. And I get 100 new numbers, where some of the original numbers were sampled multiple times, and some of them were never sampled at all. But it's a new list. I sort that list, and I find the thing in the middle. And then it comes out to be 4.5. All right? Now I do that again. I resample with replacement. I sort. I find the thing in the middle. I do that a few thousand times. And we get a bunch of numbers which sort of hover around 5.01, and they will have a spread. All right? That's called the bootstrap. All right? And if you just replace sort and find the thing in the middle with any other procedure you like, you're doing the bootstrap for sort of any procedure. So when, in fact, cloud computing started to come out, it seemed to me this is a perfect match, because cloud computing says I can have maybe a few thousand servers easily doing the same thing as one server. So what I do is I take my original data centrally, I send it out to 1,000 servers, resampled with replacement. So I get all these perturbations in my original data. Each server does whatever it does, calculates the mean or something, and they all reduce back to a little histogram, and I get the spread. So any query comes in, I can get an answer and an error bar. And I still think that this is a fantastic match. Use resampling in the context of cloud computing to get error bars on everything you ever do, and that would make the world a better place. So I don't think that's blue sky at all either. I keep reacting to this person's comment. But I think that you can teach undergrads to do this, and I think you actually start to build this into platforms, and then you can start to face the research questions, which is, for example, what if I don't have 100 points, I have a terabyte? I can't resample that with replacement and send it around all my servers. And it turns out, so we worked on that, there's something called Bag of Little Bootstraps, which solves that problem at this sort of terabyte scale and doesn't go beyond. So there's big research questions about how to scale things like that when you distribute them. We have a very long answer, but, you know, Bootstraps are a very, very simple, beautiful idea. The fact that it works is amazing. It does work. That should be widely known.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I can get closer to you by talking about Blue Sky a little bit. And let me say Blue Sky, defined it as how much it costs to get NSF to fund the kind of work that you're talking about. And when I go to think back of the days of Sputnik, you mentioned the 50s, and when we went to, I could talk about set theory and all of that kind of thing, but we now had to train teachers how to do set theory. And so they set up and campuses across the country to bring teachers in for 4 weeks and teach them how to do set theory so they could teach set theory to their school. That was an enormous investment, And I'd suggest that that's the same kind of investment that we have to do now to get to what you're talking about. You gave that great little story, but it still would take more than a minute to teach that to teachers generally, not only teachers but faculty at universities. So my suggestion, Blue Sky costs a lot of money in my definition, and I don't know that NSF, with all the pressing demands on them, could afford this kind of Blue Sky.
Okay, yeah, we are definitely on the same page. I didn't know what your definition of, I didn't know your definition of Blue Sky was.
Okay, we'll move on to the next question.
Good morning. I'm Kate Aronson from the Behavioral and Cognitive Sciences Division, and thank you very much for an interesting talk. This was fun to think about this morning. You have mentioned a couple times the idea of social and behavioral data, and that a lot of the data that's coming in big data right now is this personal data. But I wonder if you might also think some about how the individual person is thinking about this data, and you have this very nice figure that was up at the end of your talk where you related the computational side and the inferential side, but I wonder if there might also be a left-hand side to that, that is the individual querying a question. So I can think of a student or think of my four-year-old asking a question, and then how they interpret the statistics that are drawn from the computation, and whether you would place another side there, and when you think about the social science side of it, think about the cognition of individuals, and maybe this draws some from what the education director would be thinking about in terms of training individuals. So can you imagine another sort of parallel stream there in your model of where we want to get to?
No, great questions. First of all, I don't want to have too many bubbles. Then it kind of looks like an NSF directorate all broken up again. And in particular, I very much resonate to the fact that this should be about individual humans, not just in the data collection, but in the statistician. It shouldn't be the one statistician, right? So in our class, for example, we teach a little bit of Bayesian thinking. So I think of Bayes as kind of a merging of cognitive science with statistics. It's that every individual comes with a prior, a way of thinking about the data and certain questions they have in mind. And then they do an individual decision-making process. So we get into medical decision-making. And, you know, in fact, I got into all this just, let me say, about 10 or 15 years ago into data science and all because of a medical personal decision-making situation. My wife and I went in for an ultrasound. We saw the image of our now child moving around, and there was a geneticist sitting in the room. And the geneticist said, I hate to tell you this, but that little part right there, that's the heart, and there's a bunch of white spots around that. That's calcium buildup, and that's been shown to be predictive of Down syndrome. And we said, oh, really? And, well, you know, so there must have been some data analysis. And they said, yeah, there has been. I said, well, what's the risk factor now? I want to know numbers. And so it went from 1 in 300 now to 1 in 20. We said, oh, boy, that's getting kind of high. Is there some other test we can do? You know, and, well, they said, yes, you can put a needle in the uterus, and you'll kill the baby now with probability 1 in 300. And so now these numbers start to matter for me as an individual decision maker. I'm just one. There's probably 100,000 other people in offices around the country having those same decisions, right? And so these numbers start to really matter for society as a whole. It's like this all infinity. I don't want to get any of these wrong. I don't want 5% of miscarriages. So I went out. I said, I'm going to be a data scientist. Where did this data come from? Okay, what's the provenance of the data? So I went out and found it. It was a study that had been done in England about 10 years before. They collected a whole bunch of data, did a discriminant analysis, did a good job, and it found out they discovered that, in fact, white spots around the heart predictive of Downs. Definitely true in that data set. They also found that nuchal membrane width is predictive of Downs, and that's still to this day used as a predictor mark for Downs. But it turns out, so that's still used, that the imaging machines they used had a certain number of pixels per square inch. The machine they used for us had about 1,000 more pixels per square inch. All right? So suddenly all the white spots that you didn't see in the original images are now coming through in the new image, and they didn't update their data analysis, of course. Right? And suddenly all these white spots are showing up that are just literally white noise. It's false predictions. So I'm a statistician. I say, I don't think that's actually correct. You ran an algorithm, but it means it's right. Hey, I bet your error bars should be much larger. And the geneticist then at that moment said to me, wow, that's amazing. For the last 5 years, we've had a real uptick in the number of Downs cases we've been predicting. And we thought it was diet or something else, you know. And I said, no. So I said, this is transformational for society. This is not a small issue. This is And that's about a personal decision when all my cognitive apparatus, and everybody has got to bring that to play. So, yes, the cognitive science is definitely – so. But anyway, when I say inferential thinking, I in some sense want to – I don't say statistics. I want to include the cognitive sciences in inferential thinking. I believe that that's kind of the source of a lot of inferences that individuals bring to bear their own past and their own way of thinking into the data. And some of the social science then is actually – then how do we all take our different kind of analysis of the data and our different priors and actually come to a consensus among all of us? And that's also part of inferential thinking in some very broad sense.
Time for one more question.
Yeah. So speaking of people in the loop, I know you've written about this, you think of social aspects of things and social science, citizen science is becoming very popular, and the ability for people to actually provide their own cognition into systems. And I know you've written about the idea of how people can perhaps interact with these machine learning systems, with the big data systems, provide some of their own hypotheses or cognition to help the machine itself to do a better job. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about your thinking on that.
I've written some of that, not that much. I mean, I believe it's kind of one of our big open problems, data visualization, interactivity. There are definitely whole communities devoted to it. It is, again, kind of where these fields merge. You've got to have a little bit of almost art skills, computer interaction, psychology, you know, meets the purpose, the core of what the inferential problem I'm trying to get at, and how do I get hypotheses out of people, and how do I get them to, how do I assess, evaluate a prior, how do I do these things? Those are, again, kind of pan-departmental challenges. And there's this problem of aggregating things all together. Let me just maybe to finish up kind of another kind of pet peeve is about kind of how we amplify noise in journalism, for example. So, our journals are all full of studies where people carefully do statistical analysis at the 0.05 error rate and publish their results. And I think you all kind of know that it looks like that people are kind of picking the best results, so a lot of those are probably 0.05 is not the quite error. Right error rate. But then you have all these journals sitting there with quote-unquote results. And now you'll have journalists, my favorite example, the New York Times year in review, the great discoveries this year in science. That's some journalists going through all the journals looking for the surprising, interesting results. Right? Well, if 5% of these things are errorful, errors are probably pretty interesting because they're weird because they're probably false. Right, so you're probably going to have somebody selectively amplifying the noise when they do that. They're going to find the interesting ones, probably means a good fraction of them will be the wrong ones. Mm-hmm. they've been published that in the New York Times, suddenly it looks like the truth, right? And so on. This continues to feed on itself. So I think, you know, big, big problem. I think that somehow in my lifetime that I've seen more noise amplification happening, not less. And so I think that's a national, international challenge. So when you have people doing data analysis, rolling their own, you know, and so on and so forth, putting out things, great, all better. But we're going to have to even be better at thinking about how to put those together and make sure we're not just amplifying noise.
And if I could just ask one more question while we have you here. At NSF, we hear a lot of discussion about, well, industry in this area is making lots of advances, and they're putting a lot of investment into the research area. I think the Go example came out of Google research, right?
Well, I wouldn't call that industry. That's a little company that's completely academic. That wants to make it academic,
point.
You know, that was bought up by Google, you know, so let's,
okay.
let's not call
right.
that industry.
Okay, very good, very good. But in any case, a lot of feedback that we get at NSF is, well, industry is going to be investing in this area, so investments are not as important. And I wonder what your response is.
Okay, completely wrong. And I think my friend on the phone there with the blue sky remark is going to come to my help at this point, because I hope to allude to here on my slides about, you know, discussion with the boss, right? There's no – industry cannot solve those problems, okay? And, in fact, the solutions you see in industry to attempts to solve these things – use ideas that all come out of academia, okay? I mean, most good machine learning work has come out of academia, right? And that's what people are using. Most good statistics work has come out of academia. Not all, but still to this day, most, because these are hard problems. And you can't spend 5 years trying to develop a theory of differential privacy inference in industry. You just can't do it. So, yes, they can try things out. They can change the world. They can... in fact, I'm a little resistant to promoting things like Go. You know, that was an attempt to get publicity. You know, yes, it worked and all that, but Facebook and Google and all that are now kind of throwing lots of computers at AI problems. You know, aiming to partly build a business model, but also get lots of publicity. But using shallow solutions. You know, Watson is a great example of this. You know, Watson did not solve. I should say things that was in public of our videos, but did not solve the deep problems of AI at all. It was basically just a scrape together lots of data sets, put a little bit of machine learning around it, and you can do a certain amount of limited question answering. It looks pretty good, and you can, you know, get a lot of publicity. You know, that is not the natural language problem of question answering. That's not the NSF problem of the science behind how humans think about natural language and semantics and so on and so forth. So, to my mind, it's why I stay in academics. I could easily move to these companies and, you know, triple my salary or more. But I really think that it's incumbent on us. Hard problems in there that we need. You know, if we don't do them right, we have a bunch of disasters. Like my medical one is a good example. I think if we didn't do that right, you're literally at probably there was 1,000 babies that were killed that day. You know, literally.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for sharing your perspectives with us today.